God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. If you're allowed to unmute, you could say hello if you like. I don't see any hands. All righty then. This is the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and allow, solve their common and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker asket basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Judy L. from Westminster, Colorado, come to tell her story. And after she does that, we'll take a break around the top of the hour and call for maybe a few announcements, pass the seven tradition basket, et cetera. And then we'll reconvene and ask the questions that you submit. So please feel free to send questions through the chat to the user questions. Judy, thank you so much for coming to share with us tonight. I don't want to take up any more of your time. I'm very excited to hear what you have to share tonight. Please welcome Judy.
There it goes. Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Judy, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome, family. It's good to see the folks out in Virginia. We were fortunate enough to have a little few minutes to chat before the meeting and meet a few folks. It was really nice. My sobriety date is August 17th, 1982, and my home group is the Saturday Night Jive Group in Boulder, Colorado. And it's been my home group for the last 30 years. And we have worked hard over the last 30 years at trying to bring a speaker and have a little closed meeting and bring a speaker. So being here at a speaker meeting, I popped in a couple of weeks ago to hear a very nice meeting go on. And so I'm back. Anyway, greetings from Colorado. Greetings from Colorado. What I'm like and what happened and what I'm like now is the usual format for these things. I want to tell you that I pray first and I ask for the right words to come that God would have someone here. And I was told that sometimes God wants me to be the fool. So I never know what's going to get said when I go to talk. I guess I get to show up and open my mouth and see what happens. And if we're all lucky, the what I was like before and the what I am like now are different. You know, hopefully they are. You really should have had a different speaker. But you got me. So I'm a big book person these days and have been for the last 30 or so years, but I didn't start out that way. So there's some difference from beginning to end, I guess. I got sober at a little club out in Lakewood, Colorado. And that little club was like some clubs are. Yours locally may be very different, but ours was kind of a pickup bar without any booze. There was a lot of sobriety. And there was a lot of fun and a lot of dances and there was a lot of chaos and there was a lot of everything always going on at the same time. And when I came to you, I came and stayed because it felt like I was at a bar. I'm a bar drinker. I like the noise and the guys and the dancing and the booze. You know, I like the whole thing. I like the smell of an old bar. I just like that environment. And when I got to the Edit Club, brought there by a sister-in-law who was sober, who asked me to drive her to a couple of meetings because her car was out of commission. And I started driving her around to meetings. And before you know it, she'd moved on and I stayed. It was close to my house. And she stayed while, and I stayed while I didn't have a car. I lost the car. I didn't have enough money for a car. I didn't have enough money for gas. I didn't have enough money for insurance or tires. And so I gave up having a car. When I got to you, it was not the day that I was sober. I got sober in August of 1982, but I came to you in August of 1981 with this sister-in-law. And I heard a message that you carried. It's the message that's carried in most AA meetings across the country. You don't have to drink. You don't have to be miserable. You can be sober. You can live a life filled with hope and purpose and meaning, as it is promised to us in everything we read. But there's a beautiful statement that I should have pulled up and didn't, about how we have a set of principles which, if practiced and made a part of our lives, can allow the sufferer, the alcoholic, to live a life which is purposefully and meaningfully whole. And, you know, that's all the aspirations I ever wanted in my life. And I didn't know that any of those had anything to do with my alcoholism. So I came to you for a year and sat and listened at your meetings. I thought, wow, this is great. Wow, this is great too. This is wonderful. And then continued to drink the whole time. And after about a year, somebody walked in. I've told this story a lot because I think it's really important. This guy walked in. He was, I think, doing missionary work. And he said to my little 8:30 meeting, you know, there are a lot of people here because this is an open meeting, and you might be gamblers, or you might be overeaters, or you might be Al-Anons. And this group always welcomes people no matter what their problems are. But if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, what we come here to do is to quit drinking. We quit drinking and find a life which is satisfactory enough and comfortable enough that we can stand to be sober. And you could have hit me over the head with a pillow. I didn't know that. That wasn't what I was doing there. But I heard him. And it turned out that Bob, who normally went to meetings across town, Bob had a message to carry. And I went home to ask myself, you know, you've never asked yourself this question, but what are you doing here? And it took me about 2 weeks of thinking about something, about my denial, about my, well, what I would now call delusion. I'm one of those people who could tell you I don't smoke with a cigarette in my hand, right? That's the kind of person I am. So I would tell you when I got here that I had never been drunk. I had never had a blackout, but you told great stories and I kept coming back. I didn't realize that I'd been drunk every day for a couple of years. I just didn't know that. I always blamed it on, this has never happened before. It'll never happen again. Next time I'll eat first. Next time I won't go out when I'm depressed. I won't go out when there's a full moon, or I'll go out later, or I'll make some accommodations. I will read my way into a better life. And I've been reading my way through a great bookshelf full of books for quite a long time. Unfortunately, I wasn't getting any better, although I'm a great reader. So I went through this period of time for a year, and I loved my little club. And finally, I came back and raised my hand after having had what I would today call a spiritual experience, which is a phenomenon thing happened that I can't explain that brought me to a place of truth. And I came the next day. It's a long story. I won't waste your time on it. But the next day I came and raised my hand when they asked if there was anyone here who was new. A woman told me that there was kind of a sigh going around the room saying, oh, thank God she finally got it. But I didn't believe that at the time. You know, I thought they all just loved me because I was cute. I was cute. I was just having a really good time and drawing lots of attention and doing all the things that you do sometimes as a newcomer. At least maybe none of you have done that, but that's how I was. I was that obnoxious notice me girl who would come in late, stumble around, make lots of noise just to be sure that everybody knew I had arrived. And, you know, it took a while. It took a while. And the man, and it was a man, because I couldn't have heard women at the time, but there was a man who said, a couple months into that behavior, he said, "Judy," we were coming down the stairs of this little clubhouse, and he said, "Judy, keep yourself busy for a couple of weeks, stay sober. And when I get back from my business trip, you and I'll have a talk." And I didn't know it, but that man was to become a sponsor in the truest sense of the word. And that man, I needed to mention tonight because last Friday he died. And my heart is really heavy and sad because everything I needed and knew for, as a beginning, I mean, he died 56 years sober, 93 years old, and he kept me out of trouble and he kept himself out of trouble because I didn't have the good sense to have done that. And he taught me about some principles and he taught me about some traditions. And I have to tell you, I fought him all the way because I kept telling him how wrong he was because I'd been coming. I know about this stuff. He was wrong and I was right. And that's just sort of where we started. But he was a friend and mentor and guide for most of my life in the background when he was no longer my primary sponsor. So in honor of him, I couldn't have heard a message from a woman. I had a woman I'd asked to sponsor me and I couldn't hear her. She's still a friend today too, but I just couldn't hear a woman because women to me at the time, my sense of delusion is that women are powerless, men were powerful, and God was evil and out to get me. So that's kind of the places that I came in here with. And every one of those, I find as I work through the steps that what I am addicted to besides booze is my own ideas. When I have a fixed idea, it's my idea and I believe me, even if I'm lying to myself. Maybe none of you have ever done that, but that's my story. I will tell myself a story and then I'll manufacture evidence. I'm like an inner investigator. I'll make all the reporting. I'll make everything work out. And it's all a fabrication. I make this stuff up. But then because it's in my head, I believe me. So I've had a lot to undo in the course of time that I've been sober. So undoing, and you know, that... that undoing is as much as part of everything that's happened to me has been unwinding the stuff that's buried inside a diluted mind. And getting something fresh and new to put in there has been automatic after I can get rid of the other stuff. So I got to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to a year or so later, found a man that I loved and wanted to marry. He wanted to marry me too. It was amazing. Both of us at the same time, so new and so crazy that we didn't know what we were doing. I was a single parent with four kids. And he was a single parent almost with two kids. And we between us had about 14 months of sobriety. And which is, you know, like 12 minutes. Neither of us had ever been without a relationship. Neither of us had ever had a healthy relationship. And between us, we now have five marriages. So, you know, I was divorced because of my alcoholism. The father of my children wanted me to stay home and be a wife, and I could not. I'm the kind of drunk that doesn't stay home. I get to drinking and I can't come home. All I do is I start and I go out. 11 o'clock, I had a job that let me go to lunch at 11 o'clock. And what I did was I would start at 11 and I wouldn't go back. And at 2 o'clock, I'd be calling in more babysitters. And at 2 o'clock, it's like, why go home? Somebody's going to be mad at me anyway. And then because I'm out anyway, and because all the men look delicious, all kinds of stuff has to happen. So that's kind of where I came from. And yet I met this man that I really was crazy about, and we became a couple. And 5 years or so later, we moved in together. We bought a house and moved in together. And 7 years later, we got married. So we did stuff back kind of backwards. We bought a house big enough to house all of those miserable, awful adolescent kids. And, you know, my dating scene had looked like no matter who was courageous enough to be in my wacky life, got to accompany me to a police station to pick up one of my kids several times. You know, it was probably a little disheartening for the guy on the other end of the line, you know. Well, let's see, for our date, we'll go to a police station and pick up one of her kids. I think there's a future here. Only an alcoholic would see that. You realize that. No non-alcoholic would see that as potential. He's got some insanity and mental illness going on, and I've got adolescent delinquency going on, and we were the perfect happy couple. It was, you know. So we got married. We got married in 1989. We did a marriage thing yesterday. And tried to tell this story. We got married in 1989, and I started crying. And I started crying at every meeting I went to, holding my beloved's hand, and I couldn't stop crying. And I cried and sobbed and wept and had no idea why. I wasn't unhappy. Here I was, I had gotten everything that I ever wanted. I wasn't unhappy. Everything I wanted meant that I had a house, somebody to love, a set of principles that both of us put God first, Alcoholics Anonymous second, and our couplehood third. And we were trying to do everything the right way, and I couldn't stop crying. And along came somebody who said at the exact right moment, you know how AA is, not a moment too soon, not a moment too late. At that moment, we got invited to do a big book study by a man who was known pretty much at the time. He was a past trustee, and he lived in Colorado, and he was a friend. And he said, you know, Judy, I'm starting a workshop, or we're starting a big book workshop. We're going to go through the book line by line, sentence by sentence. We're going to deconstruct it, and we're going to do everything it says together until we've gotten through that. And it's going to be in Denver at 6:30 in the morning. Would you like to come? And I said, 6:30 in the morning, gee, you know, I'd really like to, but I can't, I have to be at work by 7:30. And he said, no problem. These guys are so crazy about this program that we'll move it up to 6 o'clock so that you can be there. So, you know, with an invitation like that, oh, I'm so thrilled. I'd love to get in the car at 5 o'clock and drive to Denver every day or every week. So rain or shine, we headed into Denver. So I have to tell you, to this day, I sponsor at 6 o'clock in the morning. My sponsees are kind of proud of the fact that they're the ones that show up at 6 in the morning. They're the toughies, you know, all these bad girls that I have in my life, they show up at 6 in the morning, and they're proud of it. So anyway, long story short is that year, we met for a year. And when I came out of that, I realized that what I had never done is that I had never conceded to my innermost self that I truly was powerless over alcohol. And today I feel really strongly that a first step is so critical that it's worth a lot more sometimes than we were trying to encourage back in the 80s. We were trying to get everybody to come to AA. I heard things like, if you've come to 3 meetings in a row, you must be an alcoholic because nobody but an alcoholic would want to be here. Oh, I've been to lots of meetings. I must be an alcoholic. No, not really. And you know, people, and I had a 20-year diet pill addiction, which unfortunately they made so illegal, I can't get them. So I used to be thin and it was wonderful. And I could do everything really fast. I could go to all the meetings, and I could wash the ceiling and the walls and take care of my kids and clean the house and not have to sleep. And I never felt cold, and they made them illegal. And I looked great, which it was incident. And so we had in the 80s, we wanted everybody to come no matter what your problem was. Now, I'm one of those people who kind of came along to that invitation. And maybe that was a good thing. But what happened was in 7 years, I had never grown emotionally or at depth. And I would tell you that what I see today in myself and in many others is that Alcoholics Anonymous looks a little bit like an onion. That was a great metaphor when I got here. I could understand the peeling of the onion. But what it also looks like to me is an archaeological dig. You start at the surface and you dust away a little bit of what's there on the surface with your tiny little AA brush. No belief, no nothing to lean into. You brush it away. And then you find, oh, look, there's something sticking out. It looks like maybe it's a bone or something. And you go a little further and you dig a little deeper. And, you know, 25 or 30 years later, you realize you're down several feet in this ditch and you're still picking up pieces of things and putting the whole picture together. Does that make sense to anybody? Because that's how it feels. Thank you. So I started with delusion, and then I became a sort of member with a problem with alcohol, but I didn't ever concede that piece that seems today to be so critical, which is surrender to my powerlessness over alcohol and over the manageability and success of my life. And I didn't get that. I got here on a partial lick and a promise. And at 7 years, we went through this and I learned what an alcoholic was. One of the things I was pretty sure was that, I told you some of those, women had no power, men had all the power, darn those men. And, you know, I got here with a resentment against other governments. I got here with all kinds of things that I couldn't do anything about. And it was the men that cried at meetings that managed to kind of dissolve that anger, because I didn't know how you guys had as many emotional disturbances as I did. And I didn't know you could feel as deeply as I felt and as sad and as frightened. And I didn't know that. So over the course of time, a lot of that has changed. And a lot of that goes back to that very first year-long intensive big book workshop, where we got to do our amends together. We got to make our lists together. We talked about our defects together. And I heard people share with such an utter honesty, not to show off, not to just be, you know, big mouths. You've all got one of those in your meetings. I know you do. But somebody, every one of them shared vulnerably and honestly and generously through the course of that year. And what I learned was that I had been showing up in AA kind of like a voyeur. I had learned to repeat the steps in the traditions, but the truth was none of them have ever gone deep enough in this archaeological dig to find out where the bones were bad, where there were things that were at the very core that were causing me to be so frightened of this kind of a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous to another person. Because in NAA, for the first time, I learned that what I was somebody who had never been vulnerable in any relationship before. And I have been in a fair number of relationships. But it always had to be that I could leave and they could not. It always had to be that I was had to be secure. They had to be, and I'm not saying that right. I was insecure and they were there and they filled my needs rather than, and so they were free to come and go as long as I had somebody else coming along, either simultaneously or next, to fill in that need to be reassured, to be loved, that I was okay. You know, today I would tell you that a lot of us, and I'm one of those, but a lot of us kind of whore out for the same things. Appreciation, attention, approval. What we go through, and I don't mean that in a sexual sense. What I mean is we sell our very souls out for those, for that appreciation, that approval, that attention that we so desperately needed, But we, and that's what my conduct inventory has shown me. I use in my own sponsorship, I use the sex and conduct inventory as sex is incidental to everything else I do. The conduct, holy smokes, did that turn my head around? Ask those 9 questions of your life. And I finally began to see that what had happened was everywhere where I have had any relationship of any kind, children, parental, relative, friends, community, partners, any of that, all of those relationships had been turned into something that fed me, that took care of me, that reassured me. And it had never occurred to me that I had bent every relationship into making me okay, and never gave a fig about the other end, or not much anyway. Even those children I loved, I went off to the bar, left them alone. So, and then I left them alone when I went to get sober. Tuck them in. I got things to do. I got to take care of me. And off I'd go. I don't make a very good Al-Anon because I've been taking care of me for most of my life. And it's, you know, only AA has begun to show me that I missed the boat, that I don't get confidence and self-esteem, and I don't get a spiritual awakening by bringing people in to use them. And I didn't know that at the time. So here I was, I'd gotten married, we did this year's thing. And what happened is I stopped crying because I realized I was crying because I didn't know how to fulfill a commitment and deal with the threatened pain of when he would leave. And he kept saying, do I get to vote in this? Or are you going to make this whole decision all by yourself? And it, fortunately, he's calm and, you know, he's a good balance for me. And I was pretty sure that he couldn't possibly want me. I was too complicated, too rude, too loud, too old, too non-pretty, too heavy, too everything. He couldn't possibly want me. Let's just break this off now. And in August, we celebrated 31 years. So we've, in the course of that, I'll tell you a little more about that as we go. But that was my first couple of years of recovery. And I think for me, I've needed every single year of my recovery, because as life has changed and as I have changed, I see things differently. I can tell you today what it was like, but I can't tell you in the moment sometimes the truth, because I can't see myself. I can't see myself with great truth. So I would tell you the kind of alcoholic I am. I should have this memorized, but I'm like Dave, I'd rather read it and be sure I didn't. Here's me. And maybe some of you might identify with this. It's on page 73. And I apply it to my life. Not to my drinking life any more than to my sober life, because this completely matches who I am without a drink. Because without a drink, I can be a non-recovered, non-drinking alcoholic, right? You can take away the booze. I can still have all of the ism. I have to address the ism. So it starts with more than most people. More than most people. Normal people have these things. But more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. Have I led a double life? At least all the time. He's very much the actor. Am I very much the actor? I'm an actor to myself, which is the real point of this paragraph for me. I'm an actor to myself. To the outer world, he presents his sage character, and I present this to myself. There's a reason for that, but I like to think of myself as slightly better than I am most of the time. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. So I want to enjoy a certain reputation. When I was a kid, starting off to college, I wanted to become a surgeon, a famous surgeon, of course, a doctor who would heal nations and maybe make symphonies on the side. Nothing too grandiose about me, but I wanted to enjoy a certain reputation. And what happened was in my second year of school, I'm 18 years old and I'm dropping out because I'm pregnant and don't remember exactly how that happened. And I gave that baby away and found I didn't have the skills to barely get a job at a retail department store. And I tucked all those dreams and all that shame and all that sadness away and had reason to drink. And I have a healthy appetite for booze. And I drank until the next poor guy passed my eyesight. And I said, you'll do, come on. And we're married and we've had 6 pregnancies in the next 5 years because I got to make up for the one I gave away. I want to enjoy a certain reputation, but I know in my heart I don't deserve it. It's the story of me. I was raised with people who had values in their life that they tried to give me. A normal family, believe it or not, as normal as you get, whatever that means. But my dad died young, my mom remarried, the stepfather and my mother and my father all had pretty decent values. They each had a different religion, but I never heard religion fights in my home. They each believed in supporting the kids into lessons, and you know, we had dance lessons and organ lessons, piano lessons, accordion lessons, singing lessons. You name it, we had it. We were expected to go off and achieve. And here I am, I'm giving a baby away. My family's ashamed, I'm ashamed. And I carry that like a heavy weight the rest of my life till I get to you. And you begin to give me a way to be responsible for my life, not walk away from it, but to begin to find a way to make an adjustment to my life that really does work. So there's my certain reputation, but I know in my heart I don't deserve it. The inconsistency between the person I thought I was and the person I am, that inconsistency is made worse by my sprees. Are they all drinking sprees or are there emotional sprees where I have the frustration level of a 2-year-old sometimes and I want my way and I want to be right. And emotional sprees are dangerous for me. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. They don't fit this image I want of me. Never mind selling it to you. I want it of me too. I want that person. And sometimes it feels like the people who live inside of me, and I think there's probably a few, the people who live inside me don't always tell me what's going on. And there's a drunk that lives in there. And there's maybe some form of other people too, but they yell at me from time to time. And so what happens is I vaguely remember these sprees. I'm busy justifying, like I told you, I justified my drinking. I'm busy making excuses. Investigation is my thing. I'm telling myself why it is it's okay that I did what I did and how I did it. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him, yet I've got an observer who never goes to sleep. And she's always wanting to judge. She's always wanting to point the finger right out there, you know? So as fast as I can, I push those memories far inside myself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. And he's under constant fear and tension. And I was under constant fear and tension. It made for more drinking. And it makes for non-drinking people like myself, it makes for an ism that gets stronger as I get sober when I don't have the ability to work a program around my own makeup as an alcoholic woman. And I have to deal with that part of me that suffers when I don't have alcohol. Not the part, you know, I go back to being that person. I can go back to that as soon as I shut myself up into a place of thinking there's nothing more to learn. I have all the answers. God and I are cool. I don't need to grow. There's all kinds of attitudes I can have that I think shut me off from growing. And yet I've needed every one of these years, every one of the days of these years, to be able to deal with what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous' life when you go out to live your life with a set of principles that is part of who you're trying to become. So God and I struggled for a really long time, over a period of time, because God is big, I'm at peace. I can't tell you more than that, except that most of you who started out like I did, I blamed God for my father's death, and I couldn't accept any kind of a God who would do that to a little girl. What I remembered was people saying, God wanted your daddy in heaven to sing in the choir. And I carried that one with me all of my life. Who wants a God like that who would take a girl's daddy? Because I was a child, as were my siblings. No one wanted a God like that. And I've come to believe that I have to have a God. I don't have to justify what happened because I don't know. So I put a lot of my questions on a shelf somewhere, and maybe someday I will understand them. But I don't at this point know why it is I think that God should be Santa Claus, that I put in an order and within 20 minutes later, I should have like Amazon. God's an Amazon Santa Claus that 20 minutes later or an hour later, maybe tomorrow, whatever I ordered God to do, it should be delivering at my front door. And I think sometimes we take that approach. We say God is working for me. And everything I have read and every third step I've ever taken says I'm working for God. It's not the way I thought it was supposed to work. And it's not the way I understood it the first couple of years. But it's not the way. I don't get to give Santa Claus my order. I don't get to give this Amazon God my order and wait for it to be delivered. It isn't how it seems to have worked for me. But I want to tell you what did happen, which is that all the time, there's so much I didn't tell you. I went back to school and the year before I got sober, and I finished my degree carrying. We had a little house fire. It was part of my pre-getting sober stuff. Almost killed one of my kids driving over him. I said, something's got to be different. Took me to school. And I thought I would interrupt my drinking. I didn't try to stop. But I did drive over one of my kids and almost killed him. And I decided I had to go to school and change careers and change everything in my life except the drinking. And I went back to school and got a degree. And that whole time they let me. Now, any of you who've been to school know this isn't allowed. I carried 28 hours one semester. I carried 26 hours the next semester, and I managed to graduate. And I didn't learn a whole lot. And I was not doing anything but going to school. And my drinking really was minimal and now became weekends. But I got to school and I got finished and I got done with what I had to do. And that whole time I prayed my bum off, trying to stay awake, to do the work that I had to do, the studying I had to do. And I prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed to this God I didn't believe in. And when I graduated, the day I graduated, I was mad at my family because they didn't help me in any way, I thought. And I drove around drinking champagne in the back of a friend's car because I had gotten to graduate. I forgot all the prayers that had gotten me to that place, and I had gotten to graduate. And I immediately, as soon as God's done what God's supposed to do, I shucked it off and took all the pride over the accomplishment. And I've done that numbers of times. I ask for help. And as soon as I get, even when I talk, I ask God to help. When it turns out, it's like, look what I did. It's like, wait a minute. Look what God can do with somebody. It just isn't about me. So I was a few years sober. I want to end. I'm getting towards an end. I want to wrap up two things I really want to share with you is that my sponsor used to say, my next sponsor used to say a lot that in Alcoholics Anonymous, in case there's somebody here who's pretty new and didn't want to admit it, or somebody who's new and isn't brand new, that Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the places where you don't have to be better to get better. I think that's a huge lesson. You don't have to be better. We don't demand that, although I think many of us think, I'll get to AA when I'm respectable enough to show up. We don't have to do that. We get here and we accept people as they are, where they are. And I was told that the highest spiritual value I could have was to care for another human being. To care for the welfare of another human being is the apex of spiritual principles. So every time I think I don't feel close enough to God that I'm probably a spiritual fraud, what happens is my phone starts to ring. And I get it that for me, the voice of God comes through you. It doesn't come from on high like I thought statues were going to walk down the church and talk to me and we'd cry together and miracles would happen. And that didn't happen, but miracles have happened. And they happen with you. And you become the voice of a loving higher power because you are God's other kids. And I now have grandkids and that I'm going to turn loose on the world for the world to take care of for if and when they need that, because I'll take care of your kids and grandkids and take care of mine. And that's the commitment that we have, right? We keep the organization alive for others, and others feed that back to those we love. And that's just how that all works. So two big stories. One is that this man that I loved so much, and I married, we bought this house with 7 bedrooms so that all the kids had a bedroom. Not one of them would move in with us. And we had this giant house for a while. They all came back and eventually lived with us, but one by one, not all at the same time. And we were married about 10 years. We've had 2 times. What happened was that neither one of us had worked in inventory before we got married, and we didn't know that. Don't ever marry somebody who hasn't done their amends. That is just not a good plan. There always was a he. I just sort of intellectually, like reading the steps, I knew it here, and I could say it. It must mean I'd done it. No. There's so much work that can be left that changes me by doing my amends. So we were both together in this beautiful life that we thought we were going to live, and we started to not like each other. I stopped crying. We had a couple of great years. We worked a program. We became an AA couple on campus. And next thing you know is we are hating each other, or we're at least not liking each other very well. And I find myself Googling when he's not home, how long does it take to hold a pillow over somebody's nose? Because I don't want to divorce him. The kids would be so disappointed, but he's got to go. And I can't go to prison. I've got kids, right? So we have to find some other way. So a pillow was the plan. And he's a big guy. So it turned out that I couldn't hold the pillow over him long enough. He would definitely fight back. And so we gave up the plan, and with a lot of sponsorship. I gave up the plan and got tired of whining. And I had whined to out of town because you don't take your stuff home to your own nest. I whined to people out of town like crazy. And all of them got together on the same day, apparently, and said the same message. And I heard it. And I heard it was time for me to work like traditions and be a wife and work traditions in my family. I find that emotional sobriety escaped me, even though I thought I had it together. And then it grew back. This dependency on other people to provide me with the security in my life. I'd look at him to see how I felt. I'd take everything personally. My day could be ruined. I was angry all the time. And I didn't know. I didn't go join Al-Anon. I tried working our program and I tried working our traditions. And it took about a year. It was about a year and a half going into getting really bad. And it took us about another year or so to come out of that with the help of a lot of sponsorship, and a lot of hard work. And we have managed to still be married and still get past it because none of you guys suggested that we go get divorced. You all said you made a commitment. Why don't you figure out how to live together? Why don't you figure out how to use the principles of this program with another human being? Why don't you try just once, you know, to fill somebody else's bucket instead of your own? But I was so sure I wasn't getting what I needed. And anyway, here we are. Here we are some years later. So I share that story because I think recovery is a process that takes a long time. It shows up in my marriage. It shows up with my kids. A couple of them, they've not ever totally forgiven me for the damage I've done. There's distances. I feel like sometimes like I'm allowed to get so close, but no closer. The boy I gave away, I knew he was a boy. I knew he'd been given away. In those days, that's what you did. And that boy, I found him, you know, my investigative skills. I found he's a grown man. I actually stalked his house, but he doesn't know that. And I found where he lived and made a lot of, and I made a lot of inquiries, and it took me about 5 years trying to make amends in case he wanted to talk to me, understand what happened. And I thought it was important because I'd heard so many of your stories about loss and about adoption and about pain and grief, that I just have this life that I think has to be honest. And I don't know what he's feeling. So I wrote him this deniability letter, allowing him some space. And I talked to the people who had been our intermediaries and was a family friend. And this old family friend or former family friend and his now wife met us and met me. And they would only meet me in a public place. And I wanted to ask them if they would let me talk to him wherever he had gone. And the woman leaned forward in the couch, you know, like, and looked me right in the eye with the dagger eyes, those eyes. And she said, "I just want to know if my husband was the father of this child." And I was stunned. I was shocked because, of course, that had never even been in my mind. I had been in my mind, but not him. And we had nothing like that. He had been dating my sister at one time. And in the first of the many lessons around that boy, the first of many lessons was that when we drop a pebble into the pond of life, we throw a pebble in. And it creates ripples, and we don't ever know where those ripples are going to go. And one of those ripples had been a negative force, like a stone or a thorn in the middle of this woman's marriage for the past 30 years. At every gathering where they were tangential. They were family to the boy I gave away at a distance, distant family. And all that time, she had thought something that wasn't true. And it has made me look at ninth step and how we look at who we have amended differently. And when I do an eighth and ninth step with people today, it's not about whom have I hurt. Because the truth is, I don't know who I have hurt. I am too self-centered, and I don't have the complete picture. Both those things conspire to say, how do you know who you've hurt? And what I've decided is that the only way to know is to look at my relationships everywhere I can find them and see how they are. Kind of, is there something between God and me and you in a little triangle? Is there anything there that needs to be repaired or mended or fixed or talked to? Have I offended you in some way I don't know about because there's something wrong with this balance of God and you and me? I today, and COVID has been a great teacher, I today want to be okay with every human being. I don't look to see who I've hurt because I don't know. I'm too self-centered most of the time to have any idea what hurt I may have caused someone, psychically, spiritually, sexually, morally, ethically, financially, all the ways in which we deal with amends. So I'm really particular about that. And I share that because that one shocked me so much. And I've occasionally found out that I throw a ripple in a pond today. My intention is that the ripple is a good one to counteract maybe some of the ripples I put out during all those years. I hope to put something good back in to mitigate what wasn't, you know. There's a lot of us that take care of dying parents or kids or exes, whatever's. There's all kinds of things that AAs are doing all around the world as we make our amends to life. So that was really a big deal, but then comes the boy. And I found him, she wouldn't tell me, she never did believe me, this wife. She decided he may not know that he was adopted, and that's really valid. That's really valid. So I wrote him a discreet letter under the guidance and sponsorship of someone identifying to him, if he wanted to, why I thought he might be my child. And was he interested in taking it a next step? And he called about 2 weeks later. And I want to tell you, I talked to you before about my delusion and illusion in my life. And I had told all of my meetings, I'm really lucky, I've always been a meeting goer and I get a lot out of meetings. I appreciate them and always feel better. So I was going to a lot of meetings back when we could do that. I was going to a lot of meetings and I was telling everybody my circumstance, that I had this child and I was trying to make amends, and I'd done what I could with the child, and I'd done what I could because I was now, I think then 15 years sober. And I was okay, and God was in the center of this, and it was going to be godlike, and it was going to be wonderful. However it worked out, I was okay. That's what I thought. That's what I planned. And when he called and said he not only didn't believe he was adopted, he, even if he was, he didn't want anything to do with me. He had no interest whatsoever. And the dime dropped one more time. I realized that I had created for myself a world that didn't exist. I did not know. And as I lay on the couch sobbing, because you had made me the kind of person I was not ashamed to introduce to a child I gave away and admit my wrongs. And I was okay with me today. I am a woman of dignity, and I'm a woman of honesty, and I'm a woman who puts something back into the world. And I know that about myself. And I wasn't ashamed. But it never occurred to me that he would want nothing to do with me. When I was having all those talks and talking about God and I, and we're all okay, I had never even thought that he would. I mean, it had never entered my mind that he would take that, because I just never did. So I was devastated and lay on the couch, and my phone rang within 5 minutes. And I was laying on the couch, just, you know, a puddle. And the phone rang, and a now deceased friend of ours, Bob, called. And he was a member of Edit Club, and where I got sober. And he said, I just want you to know that if nobody told you today that your life matters, I called to tell you that your life matters. And I thought, well, there's a coincidence. And then he said, well, my wife Eileen has had a heart attack, and we're over at the hospital, and she can't even remember her name, but she remembers yours and wants a hug. And I wondered if there's any chance you could come over. And I heard the little voice that only ever so often in my life has ever spoken, that says, that just tells me how it is. And what I heard was, you don't get to pick and choose, but I will always bring you what you need. But I bring you what you need. and you can trust that. And so from that day on, that day we just put on our coats and went over to the hospital is what we did. And I've been at peace with that boy since then. And I've told that story a lot because there's so many of us that have been some part of that same triangle, and it's a place of forgiveness. I do genealogy, some with my family, and I've so far found three, on the other side of the blanket kids, and been able to be really welcoming. And every time that's happened, I feel like I am the one who has gotten the benefit from, it just fills that little piece of mine that hadn't quite ever healed, that I can watch somebody else discover their family and bring them pictures and welcome them. It has been a big part of my own recovery, I guess, in that area. So it's what I get to do with that. So I'm involved in service. I would be remiss if I don't tell you that I have been involved in service most of this time. And I've hated every job I ever had. And everyone has made me a better, different person. Everyone has taught me not to be afraid of conflict. Everyone has taught me a little more how to show up, have my own opinions. Every one of them has taught me how to respect the opinions of others and not to take it personally. And at some point, it's allowed me the opportunity to learn more about the organization of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I encourage anybody who doesn't have a position, who thinks we can't find newcomers, go work on a committee for a while. They need members. They need us. They need us involved in corrections. We spend a lot of time thinking all our members are going to come out of treatment centers. But I got to tell you, homeless shelters and correctional people, those are our people. And nobody's spending any time getting those guys out and welcoming them and making them a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm hoping that we don't have to be afraid of our people, because sobering up, our people are good people, most of them. And I'm really excited about the chances that maybe we'll be able to get virtual meetings into some of our institutions and bring some of the folks there where they can meet us and be welcomed, because treatment centers doing what they do, but we've got a whole lot of people that we're not getting to, and that's our job as a group of Alcoholics Anonymous, as any group of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know. I'd like to end. There's every now and then I think, well, and then I want to tell you one more thing, one more story. But what I want to end with is a story that my sponsor used to tell at the end of his talks. And you know, I've had four sponsors in 38 years, three of whom are now past. And everyone has given me their heart. It's made me who I am. So he used to end this sponsor with a story, and it goes like this. It's Italy, and Michelangelo is out there with this giant piece of marble, and he's chipping away at the marble with his hammer and chisel. And David's half out of the marble, that beautiful glowing statue of David. He's such a hunk, by the way. But anyway, there's David, and he's part out of that hunk of marble. And the drunk walks up, is the way I think of it in my head. But it's a guy walks up. I think he's a drunk. And he says, boy, that's really great. How did you know that he was in that block of marble? And Michelangelo says, well, I didn't. I only chip away the parts that are not him. And David is what's left. So with us as the willing block of marble, and God is the sculptor, and life is the chisel, we can live a life that is magnificent and beautiful and fulfilling, because it does take us as the willing block of stone. I love you. Thank you for my life.
Oh, Judy, thank you so much. Spoke right to my heart. Everybody has the ability to unmute and thank Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Judy, thank you.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
Very kind of you.
Hey, Judy, smile to the Flatirons for me.
Thanks for sharing, Judy.
Have you been there?
I lived there for a few months. I hit my bottom there.
Me too.
Thank you. All right. Judy. I'm gonna grab the meeting back. And we'll give Judy a break. I have seen the Flatirons. I am destined to return as well. just as a quick reminder to everyone, please send your questions for Judy to the user questions. It's really Larry. And I've posted the Seven Tradition link. The Seven Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seven Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? I have allowed you to unmute.
I'm Beverly, alcoholic.
Hi, Beverly.
I really appreciate Judy's share and her mention of correctional facilities. We're in dire need of volunteers in this area. You can contact the correction chair at tidewaterintergroup.org. Please volunteer. Thanks,
Beverly. Anybody else? Alrighty, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close this meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right. So once again, here's my final, maybe not my final, but another plea for your questions. Let's see what Larry has gathered. There's a few. We could use a few more. Dear Judy, in the beginning of your talk, you talked about when you were first kind of coming in and making sure that everyone knew you had arrived, and you described this spiritual experience where you came to a place of truth. And I'm just curious, what was the truth?
I had always considered myself probably a problem drinker, in the extent that I knew that when I drank, I never drank one. I knew that I couldn't drink one successfully, and I had tried for a long time to do that. But I didn't know that was alcoholism. When I came here and fought that whole idea of alcoholic, my concept was that it was a man under a bridge with yellow tennis shoes. I mean, that was just, or someone who had tried to commit suicide. It was not some impoverished, poverty-stricken, divorced, pathetic, suburban mother. It just wasn't my image. So I was closed to the idea that alcohol was a problem for me, to the extent that I was an alcoholic. And the truth was that my life played out before me, and it showed me all of those lies, one after another, after another, after another. And I realized that I had always made my biggest most foolish mistakes by my life when I was drinking. And that was the start of an opening to what was it about alcohol. And then I realized that I never once had one drink. And then I realized that I'd sold out my life with my kids and my husband and my jobs. It was like a gradual, if this is true, then what about that? If that's true, then what about that? And eventually I realized that that's maybe what alcoholism was. That was as close as I could come at that time. My spiritual bottom with alcoholism came 7 years later.
The trustee that invited you to the 6:30 Big Book study and moved it to 6 a.m. for you, was that Don Pritz? One of my heroes, and I only know him from tapes. But do you have a Don Pritz story that you'd like to tell, or anything?
I have lots of Don Pritz stories. All of us who were fortunate enough to have us in their life and in our life followed Don around like a flock of ducklings, you know, and I just told you his ending, his story about the Michelangelo story. But Don brought the Big Book to Russia. And the first time I heard him talk about it was at the Seattle International. And they had found the story that everybody probably already knows, but I'm going to tell it to you because it's been an impactful story from before my time, actually. Denver young people, Don got out of prison. And it's what keeps me going back to prison is knowing that there's another Don Pritz there somewhere. And Don got out of prison and was told, if you're going to be on probation, it's probation, I think, you better get to a meeting that same day. And you have to have a job within 48 hours. And Don went to the club in Denver, the York Street Club, one of the oldest clubs in the country, and walked up those big old steps. And Gary Brown was there to greet him at the top of the steps. And Gary became a sponsor, and they became the foundation for a whole lot of what became known as the Denver Young People Set. And they were taking all of the meetings, they'd all pile into two cars and take meetings every night of the week. They were like on fire, and they charged up an entire state. They were so on fire, this little bunch, that they went to meetings and one of those people was the guy that came to the club where I got sober, doing his missionary work, by the way, before I knew of a Don Pritz. And they fired up Denver everywhere they went, and they got into service, and they became, and Don was a corrections chair. And anyway, that's all a big story of that. So Don and the bunch, they went to the 1975 International in Denver when they rewired our stadium with coffee, a gigantic coffee pot, the biggest one we've ever had. And then they piped in coffee spouts all the way around the stadium so people could just go and get their coffee filled. And they heard a guy, from Saskatchewan whose name I can't recall right this second. And he talked about the golden slippers. And there was a group, they just couldn't stay sober. And they got together and they decided they'd do what this book said and walk through it step by step, page by page, the whole thing. And they would see if that would actually make any difference. And the whole bunch of them stayed sober. So that guy, who was, I think, a trustee or a delegate from Saskatchewan, impressed Don and the group who were here in 1975 with a few years of sobriety and a whole lot of enthusiasm. And so they started doing that. They used to meet in this guy's basement. There were 14 of them. There's three of those folks still alive that we know of, maybe four, and a couple of ex-wives along the way as well. But there were, you know. And it's us in all of our flaming glory. And they were on fire. And that flame, those flames haven't gone out. And at one point, Don said, those of us that were his people were his legacy. And the deal going into a big book study was that if he would do it for you, you had to be willing to do it with other people. So there's little pockets all over the place of people doing big book studies who have had that chain, that lineage, if you will, if not of a, not making one person better than another, but only one guy out of that whole bunch ever drank again. And he died, froze to death in an alleyway. After having done 10 years of really good service work at a treatment center. But that was the founding of that whole Denver thing, which has gone on to impact a whole lot of people in other places and other countries. Don got a job when he got out of prison. That's my Don story. That's Don got a job when he got out of prison. You may have heard that in his tape. He went and filled out and they told him not to lie on his application. So he went and they said, you know, they asked for all the personal data and he put down, you know, right out of jail, drug smuggler and the charges and all the stuff. And the guy interviewing them said, well, turns out that they had a paper delivery. It was in a really bad neighborhood and they kept getting roughed up. And they said, we think you might be the guy for this job. We need somebody with a few extra skills. And Don was hired and kept his parole and started on his route from his second day out of prison. So that's my Don story for today.
Thank you so much. Let's see, you mentioned 9 questions earlier. I believe it was in the relationships or sex inventory. Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah. It's the where have we beens.
Okay.
I underline them. I think there's 9 of them down to what were our faults? What are our mistakes? What should we have done instead? Where have I been? And was it selfish or not?
So, and I'll just read this. I have this tendency to interpret the questions as I'm reading them, and I shouldn't do that. I'm just going to read what's written. When you figured out that you were an alcoholic, how did you determine that your life was unmanageable?
Oh, that's easy. My life was unmanageable before I determined I was an alcoholic. That's the hook I got first. Picture this. I'm on food stamps. I've got 4 kids. I'm unmanageable. I don't have a car. My love life was bad. My kids were in jail in every day, practically. Everybody dropped out of school. I had a degree and all my boys dropped out of school. My family was angry with me much of the time. And my house was being foreclosed on almost every month. There was nothing in my life that felt manageable. And more than anything, I wanted to pull my kids out of where they were and help them to grow up. And I wanted that desperately. I just didn't know how to stay home to do it.
Thank you. In early sobriety, how did you cope with all the changes in your new way of life?
Oh.
Or excuse me, how did you cope with all the new changes to a new way of life?
Well, I was already coming to a meeting a night. And I had begun transitioning to an Alcoholics Anonymous routine, if you will. I think I'm much more a person of routine than I thought I was. You know, spontaneity is only good at 2 in the morning when you're trying to get to your favorite liquor store before it closes. And it doesn't work so well when you're sober and you want to show up the next day. But how did I adapt to the changes? You know, really very badly. None of this was done that was pretty. I was busy tapping the boy part of the program first. There's always a guy somewhere, you know, and my little club was beginning to get small. And I really had to only get a piece at a time. Somebody walked me through a second step, and it took me 9 or 10 months to get to a place of a second step. People were praying over me, with me, around me. They were huddled in groups. They tried very hard, and I couldn't get past my own defiance. So I came with a body. When I take that second step with somebody, I would tell you that I came. And then I came to. And then I came to believe. And I wasn't sure in what. And then I came to believe that it was possible. And then I came to believe that a higher power. And then, so for me, it has been like very piece by piece, trying to change these addictions to what I already believed. Really an uprooting of what I believed when I got here. I don't know. I hope that's useful. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you. You seem to make a distinction between denial versus delusion.
Oh, yeah.
I know denial is kind of a popular fellowship word. Our book describes delusion. Is there anything worth talking about there?
Well, I try really hard not to use therapy words because I never know what the heck we agree they mean. So when I talk about delusion, I mean a belief in something that doesn't exist that I would believe up to the point of death. This can't be true. It can't be true. I have decided, and maybe it's not true. Darn. I'd love to be right, but I'm so addicted to how I think. You know, we could live in our intellects alone. And somebody once told me, if it wasn't for my, it needed it to breathe, my brain would have killed off my body, but it needs it for transportation. You know, and that's just kind of where I come from. My brain would do, and even today, it's easier to think my way through a program than it is to do the actions of the program. And that challenges, I try never to talk about God and then realize that what I am in a place of fear, babbling about a God I'm not trusting. I want my insides and outsides to be as close the same thing as they can be. Does that make sense?
Yes. How do you practice Rule 62?
You start with myself.
For anybody who's new, Rule 62 is don't take yourself too damn seriously.
So one of the things that I do, so here's the story. We got enough time? Yeah. I'm involved in service. We have a service assembly. We went to one in Mississippi or in Missouri. It's in our region. And we had a full weekend of hearing all of these trustees and delegates and more trustees and people from GSO, and everybody gave reports, and we were all spiritual and wonderful, and we were all involved and terrific members. We were full of it. You know, we really were full of goodness. And we're leaving the hotel to go over the bridge to the parking lot to drive home. And there was somebody in there who was setting up for the next event at the hotel. And they had shiny pink gift bags with tissue popping out of it in different colors and stuff in it. And my first thought was, I can get four of those to the car before that guy gets back. And I'm 36 years sober. And it's my first thought. So what I did was first I tell my husband, and then I start telling my sponsees, and then I admit it to my Wednesday night meeting, because that takes me to a place of admit my faults to God and to my fellows as fast as those little weeds sprout. That way, none of us have any delusion about exactly where my feet are planted.
Right on. Thank you. Which service position do you hate the least? No, what's your favorite service position and why?
Oh, the reason I hated all of them was because they all demanded of me that I grow up and put myself second. And it's not something I ever wanted to do. This is a selfless program. It's a help others program. And I am intolerant, opinionated, judgmental, and really willing to take everything personally. So everyone that has meetings has been hard for me. Everyone, my favorite is registration at a group, at a thing, you know, an AA thing, because then I get to say hello to everybody and I know everybody's names. And that's why, because I'm a nosy busybody who likes to know the people and connect their names and their faces when I see them for the rest of the weekend, so that I'm comfortable.
So you probably like being a greeter too, then.
I love being a greeter. I'm good at it.
All right, we're coming close here, but we got room for a couple more. You said something that really intrigued me when you were talking about amends, and there was sort of a departure from amends to people. You were talking about not being able to know the harm to others, mm-hmm. and you used the phrase "make amends to life."
Yeah,
I don't know. That just lit me up a little. Is there anything else in there? Make amends to life. Help me understand that.
None of us exists all by ourselves. We contribute to life or we take from life. And we do it one person at a time, maybe. But the truth is that I have brought everything from when I was newly sober, I found myself really being ugly to the grocery clerks who didn't understand why I'm the most important customer in the store who has to be gotten through the line first. And I'm the only driver on the road. And there's like an only me that counts attitude towards how I live. And today, in little ways, I'm trying hard to be a bringer of a different energy as a way to make amends for how I have taken for most of my life. I guess that's as close as I can get. We've been trying for the last 30 years to make our children's holidays and time secure and comfortable and supportive from us because we felt like we took that away. I made personal amends with each one and a whole lot of people. You know, the stealing stuff, that's easy to make amends for, just give them back their money plus interest. But the harms that are emotional, those are a lot harder.
Thank you. So with the few remaining minutes we have left, I wonder if you would share what being a member of a home group has meant to you through the years.
Yeah, I've been a member of the same home group for 31 years. They're 31 years old. And we've been both the biggest meeting in town and the smallest meeting, because meetings are like that. And I find that I don't go to it because it's the popular meeting. I go to it because it's my home group. And because in doing that and in doing service, what I learned to do is to make a commitment and keep it. What you have taught me was to make a commitment and keep it. And then later I learned how to do it with some pleasure. But make it and keep it and see if I can contribute. And that's part of building one's self-esteem. What I would tell you is that this isn't a home group answer. This is a personal answer. I came here believing that I was a mistake. My sixth step looks like I'm too defeated, too defective, too broken. In the last 8 years, although I don't have an agent, so they're not published, I've written three books. And I've written three books. I'm thinking about what I want to write next. I'm almost done with the three of them, not perfect. But I spent most of my time saying that I couldn't do any better because I was too fragile to stand criticism or to make mistakes. My home group and services taught me that I can make mistakes and still be a member and still be a part of things. So today I know that my only failure is if I refuse to write because God gave me a gift with that. But it is not about, am I going to be William Faulkner or William Shakespeare or any of the other Williams? I started too late to have that kind of a career. But my mistake is if I refuse to take the risk of doing what God gave me the ability to do. Because I'm not a mistake. I'm a person who makes mistakes. There's a big difference.
Thank you so much. You were so generous with your time and just a beautiful 90 minutes with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everybody will get the opportunity to thank Judy again. I'd like to thank everyone who participated. Larry for wrangling the questions and just for caring enough to show up. And I wonder if Leanne would read a vision for you.
My name's Leanne. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leanne.
I have a vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you, Leanne.
All right, thank everybody. Let's have a virtual circle and feel free to unmute and we can have a static filled feedback bound version of the Lord's Prayer. If you would like.
Yes.
Our Father.
Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, power, and glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Thanks, Judy.
Keep coming back.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you so much. Come again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
It was lovely. And Howard, it was so good to meet you as well.
Nice listening to you, Judy.
Thank you.
It was great.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much. What a great bunch of folks you all are. A great meeting, by the way.
Oh, thank you. You just cracked my heart wide open, Judy.
Yes, I mean, you seem very comfortable. I feel very comfortable listening to you.
Thank you for your
messages. I appreciate every one of them.
They all came from elsewhere and just filter on through. You know how that works.
Yes, yeah, I do. Yeah. Even through osmosis, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, good night. Thank you so much, Jay.
Thank you, everybody.
And everyone well,
thank
else
you, Judy.
That, take care.
Judy. Good night. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Night.
Thank you, Larry.
And
love you, brother.
God bless.
God bless. Thank you.